This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Making sure a child is getting the best education possible has its challenges, not the least of which is struggling to get through to a child with a history of disruptive behavior. Finding a way to crack the code of disruptive behavior could make a huge difference.
It's not how the behavior looks, but what the underlying cause of the behavior is, and that really fuels how to best intervene.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the behavior code. We'll also find out about a new effort to grade the nation's schools of education, and we'll spend an academic minute with some nice round numbers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Based on a collaboration dating back nearly a decade, a behavioral analyst and a child psychiatrist have set out to reveal their systematic approach for deciphering causes and patterns of difficult behaviors and how to match them with proven strategies for getting students back on track to learn. Their new book is called The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue recently spoke with the pair. Jessica Minahan, a board-certified behavioral analyst and special educator who is currently working in a Newton, Massachusetts school system, and Nancy Rappaport, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School.
Well, I've been working in the public school systems for the last 20 years, and there was a particular patient that I had seen consulting with the school from what a principal described, and this is Dr. Rappaport talking right now, as going from 0 to 100 in a split second. And I was very impressed with the concrete strategies that Jess had developed to be able to turn the behavior around with this student. And it felt to me so important to be able to think together about how we could take the knowledge that's available about understanding children's behavior and make it available for teachers, because so often when I've done intensive psychiatric assessments, these are kids who can be very disruptive in class, and we needed to heighten the preventative kinds of things that can be done with children. And I was fortunate enough to team up with Jess and the Harvard Ed Press and come out with a book that we hope becomes not to overstate it, but a classroom Bible for teachers who want to find answers.
Jess, I think it's interesting in the subtitle of the book, of a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. Step one implied there is understanding.
Yes, I think that's one of the biggest hurdles for teachers, because a lot of times this behavior looks purposeful, looks manipulative when a student is standing toe-to-toe with the teacher with their arms crossed saying, "I'm not doing it." Teachers jump to conclusions about students. So I've heard, you know, they're manipulative or they're trying to disrupt the classroom, when in fact what we really want to teach is that it's a skill deficit. And students, Nancy and I believe, like Ross Green says in his book, The Explosive Child, a student would behave if they could. So when a student is not behaving, it really is because they can't, and that they have some skill deficits, just like a student with a learning disability can't read and has skill deficits in reading. And that's the biggest lesson we want to focus on, is what can we be doing to teach kids these missing skills.
And Nancy, I guess just for a baseline knowledge of the difference between a deficit and a disability, of what we mean by challenging.
It's a good question. Some kids do have disabilities, such as autism or bipolar disorder, where it also may be that they have deficits, say, in being able to communicate what they need. But what we're asking is for, and again, we understand and we both support teachers in their and parents, but we want people to step back and become curious about the behavior. So one of the things that we talk about is looking at the antecedents, the behaviors, and the consequences, so that looking at the behavior, looking at what's going on before the behavior, and that can often give you a clue. Because many times, if you have an explosion with a child, what gets focused on, think about just today with the girl, unfortunately, getting handcuffed in Georgia, is that the focus is on the outburst, but not what happened before and what are the consequences and how do sometimes adults in children's lives inadvertently reinforce that. So that can happen with a variety of kids, and that's what we try to talk about, that yes, you want to have a differential about some of these diagnoses, but then you also want to have practical strategies with how to intervene.
You talk about the behavioral problems of anxiety and oppositional behavior and withdrawn behavior and sexualized behavior. It doesn't have to be just one, does it? These can overlap.
And they often do. The chapter we chose to write about first are students with anxiety, because I think that's the most counterintuitive type of behavior. So kids can look like they're oppositional. They can scream at the teacher or refuse to do things or shut down. But the only difference, it's not how the behavior looks, but what the underlying cause of the behavior is. And that really fuels how to best intervene. So if underlying the outburst is anxiety, the intervention is quite different than if it was purely oppositional. And so we sort of chose to start with that chapter to tease out and get teachers thinking in a way that's more like a detective and figuring out some of these clues so that their instincts are more guided towards a helpful intervention.
And Nancy, when we talk about anxiety with students, are we talking about typical anxiety where words like fear and fight and flight and that kind of thing come to play?
Yes, we can be talking about the fight or flight instinct, so that sometimes when kids become anxious, they can become combative, not all kids. And sometimes kids can have a range of diagnoses, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, things, you know, where they may be overreactive. And the important aspect is let's arm these kids with an ability to figure out, for instance, how to self-regulate, how to do things like an emotional thermometer, which many clinicians are familiar with, but it's a way of being able to self-reflect and then come up with strategies about when I'm getting started towards boiling over, what are some of the things I need to do.
I want to go back to some of the behaviors in a moment, but one of the things I found fascinating about the book is that while all of this is happening, I mean, obviously the teachers are still trying to teach, and the class moves on. And these disruptions then put that student who's already having trouble one step behind, then two steps behind, then three steps behind. And as you write, they're missing this precious classroom time because they often are suspended or having detention or whatever, sent home. So how do you come to some sort of, and Jess, I guess this is as an educator, a question for you, of how you balance all that to keep this in the mind that we have to deal with the challenges that this student has, but also to actually teach them.
Right. And that's a big part of my consultation to teachers, is a lot of the first questions that I get are, when am I going to be able to teach the student these skills that they need? How do I teach the rest of the kids? And what happens is teachers can get into a sort of a little vicious cycle where the short-term solution would be to do a punishment procedure, like, you know, send them to the office or suspend or, and, you know, it's not that students aren't motivated and don't want to learn, they can't. So those kind of things don't help the student improve their behavior. And it's a short-term release for the classroom, so the disruption stops, but it doesn't teach the kids, and it's not the right intervention to reduce behavior. So the next day and the next week, this behavior will repeat. The question that I get a lot is, how am I going to fit this in? It seems like a lot of work on top of, you know, teachers do heroic work. They're completely exhausted. They have thousands of responsibilities, 26 kids sometimes in their classroom. And what I've done, you know, to help teachers realize that it's more of a long-term goal than a short-term goal, because, of course, the short-term is kicking them into the hallway or the principal's office would stop the disruption in the short-term.
but in the long term doesn't help. So in the short term, you know, I've gone into a classroom and taken data and said, you spent about 7 minutes out of that half-hour lesson redirecting the student who was being disruptive, saying his name. You said his name 45 times. If you took those 7 minutes and used them proactively, in next week and 3 weeks from now, the disruption will be reduced.
Proactively still directed at that particular student?
Yes, exactly.
So what does that say about the only 23 minutes of a 30-minute lesson that the other students aren't getting?
Well, if 7 minutes, you know, is directed at the students, it wouldn't be during the lesson. What my biggest challenge is in a public school, it's a busy, unbelievable job, and is to make it doable and practical and only take a few seconds. So, for example, for a student who argues chronically, instead of kicking, you know, having them go sit in the hallway, I have teachers write down on a sticky note what the direction that's going to, you know, be unpopular, and walk away from them, 6 feet away, and be very busy, put their back to them. Kids often don't argue if there's no one standing in front of them looking at them, and it's a really common mistake teachers make, for an example, that they stand there, give the direction, and then maintain eye contact and almost elicit a response from the kid, and then they get in this arguing loop. So that, like, really simple strategy reduces a lot of disruption. So our book is
full of things like that. So we're not saying 7 minutes for the rest of the school year. We're saying just take the time to focus on how to learn some strategies. And teachers, they want answers. So
sure.
We tried to make this very readily accessible. So the 7 minutes could be, it'll take more than 7 minutes, but take an hour and a half to read the chapter on oppositional behavior and come back in with some of the strategies that we're talking about.
And one of the points made in the book, Nancy, is that why this is so important and why we have this discussion is because these kids who behave inappropriately rarely master the skills they need to progress academically.
That's the American education tragedy right now. It's about the barrier to learning is many times behaviors that get in the way. And we are reaching out to ask us to embrace the ability both for parents to be able to advocate for what should be put in place for their kids and for teachers to have an opportunity to do this.
Jessica Minahan is a board-certified behavioral analyst and special educator who is currently working in the Newton, Massachusetts school system. And Nancy Rappaport is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Their book is called The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. They spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, the nation's schools of education are about to get a report card. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1133. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The National Council on Teacher Quality, a nonprofit policy and research center, is working on a project to rate the country's schools of education. The report is to be published by U.S. News & World Report. The Best of Our Knowledge's Paul Tuthill spoke with the think tank's president, Kate Walsh.
It's something that a lot of people have wanted to know for a long time because we have so many schools of education in the United States. There are literally 1,450. But nobody knows really much about the individual quality of those programs. So a lot of people over the years have tried to figure out how to do this right. We actually looked to a model that was started back in 1910 by a guy named Abraham Flexner. He went around the country to look at the nation's medical schools because in 1910, believe it or not, medical schools in the United States were deplorable. You could get into a medical school without a high school diploma. And when you got there, you never worked on a body, live or dead. So a foundation paid him to go around the country and rate them. And that exercise is credited 100 years later. It's credited with transforming medical education in the United States and really bringing about wholesale improvements.
How many schools are you planning to look at, and what are the how are you judging them? What criteria are you using to come up with this with this rating?
We're looking at 1,150 schools and institutions in the country, and that's just about. You'd think it's almost all of them. They're 99.1% of the producers of teachers, and then the remaining 300 produce less than 1% of teachers. So we're looking at the vast majority. And what we're doing is we are applying the standards that K-12 educators tell us what they need in new teachers. So we talk to superintendents, we talk to principals of schools. We are ourselves a K-12 organization, so we have a very good sense of what it is schools need from their new teachers. And over a period of 8 years, we developed a set of standards that reflect what those schools need. Do they know how to teach reading? Do they know any math? Are they strong in their content area? Do they know anything about classroom management, about data and assessment? These days, teachers really have to know how to interpret data and use it to improve their own instruction, and that's something that is not occurring in a lot of schools of education. So it's very reflective of what is relevant to K-12 education.
Are the schools cooperating with you?
Interesting that you should ask. That's the tough part of this exercise is that when we announced a year and a half ago that we were going to be doing this, the schools of education were in an uproar. They did not want an external organization taking a look at what they do in this kind of very hard and specific way. And many of them organized a boycott against us, and certainly that's been very prominent in Massachusetts with both the public and the private institutions there.
So you haven't had a lot of cooperation from the schools of education in Massachusetts?
No, not at all. In most parts of the country, we have about two-thirds of the public institutions who are fully cooperating. And when I say cooperating, I simply mean that they are willing to let us look at course materials and syllabi and graduation requirements and student teaching requirements. So a whole array of what it takes to deliver a high caliber program. So about two-thirds of all the public institutions in the United States are willing to give us access to those materials, and about a third are not. Massachusetts is a disproportionate number of schools in Massachusetts. I'd say all 11 public universities in Massachusetts are refusing to even comply with an open records request into those institutions. So at least one at a reasonable rate. They're willing to turn over the materials at a very high fee, one which we know is designed to make it impossible for us to gain access.
Now, you have an agreement with U.S. News and World Report to publish your results. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely the case, yes.
And what's the publication date? Is there a publication date?
So very early in 2013, we will be delivering, we'll deliver at the end of 2012, and they'll publish early 2013. And I should make it clear that we can produce a rating of every institution with or without their giving us access to course materials. We have other ways of getting course materials than directly from the university if they refuse to cooperate. So, and we can rate all institutions against at least some of our standards without any cooperation. So we will be delivering to U.S. News a comprehensive evaluation of all the programs in Massachusetts and all the programs in the United States.
What do you expect that will be done as a result of these of this ratings being published, of this information being disclosed?
We're trying to drive wholesale change in the field. The field, it's not just this little organization in Washington, D.C. that has observed that teacher education is in need of massive overhaul. The Secretary of Education has been extremely articulate on this front, calling for a revolution in thinking. And actually, many people within the field of teacher education have observed that the field needs massive overhaul, that there are programs that ought not to be delivering teachers to public schools. So we're not unique in this thought, but certainly we are out front in the battle.
Is this going to be a grade that's going to be assigned to schools, a ranking?
We are not ranking programs. We are simply going to give them a grade, a letter grade, A through F. There are too many of them to do, 1 through 1,050 ranking. And that's part of the problem. There really are too many programs in the United States relative to what other nations have. It's very hard to produce programs of high caliber because the field is somewhat chaotic. There are just so many programs. Some of them produce 10 teachers a year. Others of them produce 300, 400 teachers a year. There really is no, there's very little governance of these programs.
That's Kate Walsh, the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle. No matter how something ranks, we like to make our grades with nice round numbers. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the 500th Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. What better way to celebrate the occasion than to look at the number 500 and our general affinity for round numbers? University of Texas at Austin Professor of Psychology and Marketing, Art Markman, does the honors.
This is the 500th segment of Academic Minute, and that is a cause for celebration. But why do we like round numbers like 500? Why not celebrate the 471st segment instead? After all, 500 is a round number largely through the accident that humans have 10 fingers and toes, rather than something mathematically elegant about the base 10 system. There are two factors that combine to create this preference for round numbers. The first is familiarity. Starting in the 1960s, psychologist Robert Zients observed that people like things just because they've encountered them before. That's why an insipid pop song that drives you crazy at the start of the summer becomes the defining sound of the season after you hear it 100 times. The centrality of round numbers based on familiarity leads to the second factor, landmarks. We love to use round numbers and anniversaries as times to celebrate achievements and evaluate progress. At the start of any venture, whether it's a business or a relationship, there's lots of excitement. After a while, though, the excitement dies down and your actions become routine. Those routines, or habits, are done mindlessly. Landmarks have two benefits. First, they provide an opportunity to celebrate a real accomplishment. That celebration can inject energy and excitement to liven up the daily routine. And second, landmarks create a time to analyze your progress. Are you happy with your life, business, or relationship? Are there things you'd like to change? Those round numbers serve as a chance to make mindful the things in life that have become mindless. So hats off to Academic Minute. Let the celebration begin.
That was the University of Texas at Austin's Art Markman. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions. which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.